Okay, so it's October 4th. So this is on page 11 where the paragraph begins, a great actor is able to perform on the same stage, sometimes as a beggar and sometimes as a rich man. But no matter what kind of person he portrays, his worth will not change. That's important. In the midst of being a beggar, we must also know it for what it is. In other words, it's being this moment beggar without getting caught up in entangling and self-centeredness and reactiveness about being a beggar, which perpetuates harming, suffering, and all sorts of other things. So if we see clearly what he's saying is that there's all sorts of roles we take, and doing whatever is appropriate in the role can be all sorts of things, whether agreeing or not, whether striving to be something else or not, at the same time not believing the roles in terms of self and other stories, or losing track of who and what we are, then we can understand and be, he uses the word, always one perfect circle. Or we could use another word, we could say, realize these true names, as in that poem by Thich Nhat Hanh. So that it's an important point to emphasize. What did you say? I'm sorry.
Which includes bumpkins.
Which includes being bumpkins too. We mentioned that last week. But as long as we see that being bumpkins is just another role we're playing, but it's not who we are. So then when we're a bumpkin, oh, I'm sorry, I don't understand this. What are you talking about? Or whatever. But unfortunately, often we take our roles as more than just roles of this moment, but we take them as the truth of who we are, and therefore a basis for doing all sorts of things which are, if I say it simply, counterproductive. But we talked about this before, but I wanted to reiterate that point because it's important to see it in depth, because it's, in a sense, an antidote for much suffering or dissatisfaction. It isn't a encouragement for any kind of passivity or saying, oh, well, I can't do anything or whatever. That isn't what it's talking about. But it's playing the role and yet not being stuck in the role. Sometimes when you see an actor playing very different roles in very different situations, films, theater, etc., sometimes we see actors who are always playing the same role, no matter what the role is. And in a sense, that's being a poor actor, because then they don't really embody the character and the role that they're playing. Instead, they're blinded by, what should I say, their self-habits. So, anyway, that's all I want to say, unless you want to bring up some more. But I'd like to then begin this next chapter, a lot of which...
Elihu, I have something just very quickly to add.
Sure.
When you're talking about roles and having to, you know, not be clouded by them...
Yes.
...or not be, you know, stuck in them if they're not good, it reminds me of Joko's talk that she gave on what's required...
Uh-huh.
In this moment, right now, what's required if you're in a situation that's a bad situation, a hard situation, whatever situation it is, if you have to step forward and get out of it or do it or try to make it better, you know, what's required right now?
Yes.
And I put that on my mirror, and, you know, I look at it every day still, even years after I heard her tape on that.
Yes. Good. What's required right now? And sometimes what gets in the way of seeing that is our, if I say it another way, our attachment to all our stories about this role or all our entanglements of should and shouldn'ts, to simplify it. So, good. So let's start with the next section, which is all existences are Buddha nature. And I don't have much I want to start with. I want to hear more what you have to say than what I have to say. But let me bring up a few points I want to make. It's interesting, on the second page in this chapter, which is page 13, in the middle of the page, he makes an interesting point. He's talking about the human instinct for life preservation, etc., etc. And he makes the point, our urge, he says, this is the, let's see, it's the chapter, the paragraph in the middle of the page where he begins the human instinct for life preservation. And at the end of that, he says, our urge is to seek endless life and endless expansion. And he says, Buddhism teaches us how to satisfy this urge, but we could add, satisfy this urge without causing additional harming and suffering. In other words, how do we satisfy life by nurturing joyousness or nurturing even satisfaction, compassion, and peace? In other words, how do we become aware of how, of the harming that our urges and urges to attempt to satisfy urges may cause to others and to ourselves? So part of that, in another way, if we say it, to be able to see clearly what urges are self-centered and self-entangling or self-perpetuating, and what urges, how to satisfy these in a way that doesn't perpetuate that. I think that's an important point. And I don't know if anyone wants to say anything further about what he's saying here about urges. So please don't let me be the only one to speak. No, no. So I want to go ahead.
I think it's a little simplistic. You know what he's saying.
Speak up.
It seems a little simplistic.
Yes, that's why he's just getting us going, and then we have to extend it further. I mean, we. So, what do you find simplistic about it?
The two strongest desires are the desire to eat and sexual desire.
Yes.
I think there's a desire to survive. I think he's missing something very important, and that kind of dovetails with some of the stuff he says later, actually. But, you know, there's this very strong desire to survive.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not seeing that come out in this part.
Well, he says, but the instinct for life preservation will always remain, on the previous page. The attachment to life may become weak, but the desire to live as long as possible will stay the same throughout one's life. I mean, that's what he's talking about.
Ella Hughes, this is Debbie, and just indulge in it, because I had notes in the side about Powell, to me, this was similar to that new book on why Buddhism is true. And the reason why I thought that is because both books are trying to take kind of like what is perceived as like basic human nature. And in his book, it's like from an evolutionary standpoint, to improve, to constantly improve and constantly strive and preserve life is the basic human instinct and causes suffering because it's never enough and it, you always have to keep, and that Buddhism is a way, a path to try to reduce your suffering by looking at your cravings and your expectations, looking at it and trying to let the striving go. But what I found is interesting is that maybe this is the first time I've seen in a Buddhist text really some kind of acknowledgement that it's really, this is what we have to deal with, is this basic human nature. It's all kind of self-based, but it's what we encounter every day. And how to reduce suffering. But I still struggle then, as I was thinking it through, which is how do you still expand and hold on to life and yet not suffer? And you know, you can put that next to Buddhism, and you can, you know, look at what comes up. But at some point, you know, what is skillful? Is it to still to pursue? It's still to stay alive.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, both to sort of respond to what you're saying and what Faye, what you said, notice that I think it's the, let's see, it's the third paragraph from the beginning of this chapter. He said, where he says the two strongest desires are the desire to eat and sexual desire. And then right after that, he says both are a result of the instinct for life preservation. So he acknowledges that. And then of course, all that sort of then expands from that when it becomes self-centeredness in different ways. So it's in a way we don't even, sometimes we don't know what our instinct, instinct driven reactiveness is, because we don't have the sense of the fear or the threat that underlies reactions sometimes. But what he is simplifying, of course. And yet he's trying to emphasize the point that practice isn't saying that the issue or Buddhism isn't saying that the issue that these are problematic, but how it's how we attempt to fulfill them that becomes problematic, and how we attempt to fulfill them while not seeing what's going on, which makes it all the more difficult for us. So part of what he's gonna talk about is our need to see what's going on, or need to be aware of the present moment in ways that our habits keep us out of touch sometime with what's going on. And anyway, I'll stop there, because I think this will be elaborated in the next chapter, which is all about self and self-centeredness. So if you want, we could explore it further if you have ways, but that you want to bring it up. But if you can, I think if we put that off till next chapter, we will have a more fruitful discussion of it.
Elihu?
Yes.
I think Joyce is trying to join. She's calling. Can you see her there?
Hold on. Let's see if I see her. Let me see. No, she's not on the call, but I've tried to add her. I'll try
Checkers.
Again.
Checkers is the sort of name.
It says Checkers. Joyce, and I'm attempting to add her. I mean, she's calling me. I can't answer her without, if she just picks up.
Okay.
See, it says answering this call will place your active call on hold. So I can't answer her, but she could pick up. I in theory, I'm attempting to call her. She just needs to answer it. So,
you may have the wrong name.
I might have the wrong name. Well,
it's okay. We'll get that for another time.
Okay. So, I want to go to the last paragraph on page 13 because I think this needs to be clarified and because I think it links to a number of important things. I think somewhat the statement is, it's a misstatement. So, this is the paragraph where he begins about, if all human beings followed the precept of non-killing, there would be no wars. Buddhism teaches us to seek peace. Throughout the history of Buddhism, there have been no religious wars. Let me say, I think that's not quite accurate. So let me clarify a few things, or let's say it differently. It's only true in the most narrow sense that there have not been wars on the part of, that I could think of, on the part of Buddhist religious authorities in order to conquer. But let me start by saying, In the Buddha's, in the historical Buddha's lifetime, we have him both attempting to stop war by putting himself in the path of a conquering army, which was somewhat successful several times until he said, there's no point in doing this. And we also have him advising kings. He had a number of disciples who were kings in different Indian states where he advised them about the role of the king as a protector of the people and the need for an army. So both he taught non-killing and at the same time the non-killing was taught for those who took vows with him, but at the same time the king needs to fulfill his role as the protector of the nation. So it's sort of, in the 3rd century before the Common Era, there was an emperor in India named Ashoka, who, after conquering large portions of the Indian subcontinent, then became, whether it's because of his feeling revulsion at the cost, I don't mean the financial cost, but I mean the cost in human misery of the wars, for other reasons, he became a follower of the Dharma, and he, what should I say? He gave up war as an instrument of foreign policy, and he's famous for having undertaking a foreign policy of spreading Dharma teaching of peace. It's said that he converted to Buddhism about the year 263 BCE, and he's famous for setting up these Ashoka pillars that still exists, and edicts on the pillars encouraging ethical behavior and encouraging Dharma practice. Scholars can talk about the details of that. I don't want to go into too much details. He also set up monuments marking significant sites of the life of the Buddha. I could talk more about him, but I just wanted to bring him up as the first, a first example of a king or a ruler who tried to apply dharmic principles, both of peace and of a foreign policy of peace. At the same time, and this is important, we have many instances throughout history where there was an intermixing of national politics with, religious authorities, including Buddhist religious authorities, where the nationalism sometimes blinded them so that they supported the nation's military policies and military activities. Sometimes this occurred in China. Sometimes in Tibet you had conflicts that reflected, that different sects were affiliated with different kings. In Mongolia you had this, a little bit in Korea, and certainly in Japan, even in the last century and the end of the 19th and in the 20th century, where Japanese militarism, enlisted the religious authorities, Buddhist and others, and in a sense, they were blinded by the nationalism, which is another form of self-centeredness, except it's a self-centeredness of the nation as opposed to the self-centeredness of the individual. And because they were blinded by it, they did things which supported the militaristic and imperialistic violence, and sometimes worse. In addition, there's also times where various monastic organizations in China, in Tibet, and in Japan, to name just a few, had monks or lay people who protected the temples and monasteries and sometimes waged battles against others, sometimes resulted in them being destroyed. Now, I'm just talking in generalities. You can go into more details, but I'm not going to go into that. So religion sometimes gets co-opted and used, and when people don't see it, then their nationalism blinds them and blinds their ways of, fulfilling the precepts. So this is that's my addendum to clarify some of what he says. We could go into this detail about this further if we need to, but I don't think we need to. But I leave that up to you. I want to then go to one next point, which is his discussion of what he calls the three Buddha natures. This is on page 14. He talks about Shōin Bushō, in other words, Buddha nature itself, where he says it means fundamental cause, which fundamental in a way is another way to say absolute. In other words, what's the basic? It's the way it is despite our ideas about otherwise, or despite our not seeing it, despite believing it could not or should not be under certain circumstances, and it's in the midst of ongoing changes, which we might say, well, that contradicts it. So whether we know it or not. And the importance is, even though it's not our personal sense, it is who we are, and therefore it's something that's accessible to us. And then he goes to the next, the ability to realize it for ourselves. In other words, because it's so, also it means, therefore, we can know what's so. It's in our capacity to know what it is. And that's a very important point. It's not to say that it's so, but you're not capable of it. And then he makes the next point, which has to do, well, let me first say, Ryoin means realize, where he talks about, where it's really, it's about ability, capacity, and potentiality. But that ability and capacity and potentiality is really inherent in life as we are, and yet somehow we need to do what's called for in order to live this. Even if we want to say, even to become aware of this. And it's that becoming aware of this, or doing what's called for, is the next step, meaning doing our part so that we can see what's always so. In one sense, he's emphasizing, well, he's emphasizing the, what we do, what we say when we recite the Gatha on opening the sutra. We say, the Dharma, incomparably profound, minutely subtle, is rarely encountered, and yet now we can see it. So in a sense, this is the, nothing happens accidentally. The fact that in our life it's possible even to read about this or become aware of this is itself this manifesting of conditions which makes it possible. And that's the cause and effect aspect that he's emphasizing. That nothing happens accidentally is simply saying that cause and effect as it manifests right now, even as it manifests in us hearing nothing happens accidentally, even if we don't agree with it, even if it makes no sense to us, that itself is that cause and effect of non-accident, which keeps manifesting in our life, except that often we want to or seem to run from it or deny it or say, well, that's really not so, and look instead for what we think we don't have. So, but let's talk about this a little the way you understand these. I've sort of just made a few comments on it, but I've been talking too much about this. So let's see what you do or don't want to say about this.
You know, Elio, this kind of reminds me of the I think it was Los Angeles or something like that, or LA, something, with Steve Martin and his wife. And it was about Steve was receiving messages from beyond, or you know, from a higher power, or whatever you want to call it. And he kept saying, oh, I wish you would just give me a sign. And then this big truck pulls in front of him with a bunch of signs, and has an accident and some of the signs fall off the truck. And it's a humorous look at it, but in a way it was meant to be at that point. So that it was always there. What I'm saying, it seems like, you know, we have the situations that are always there for us to uncover if we only look to see it.
Well, if only we look to take advantage of it. I shouldn't say the word advantage. A better word doesn't, to make good use of the opportunity, because the opportunities are always present, whether it's the fact that we're alive, the fact that we hear it, the fact that we have enough health and consciousness so that we can do something to whatever extent we can. And if instead we think, well, I need ABC in order to do it, well, then we never get to the ABC because we don't see the DEF right now that's making it possible. There's a joke which I've told before. It's usually told in the context of God, but it's the same joke where there's a flood and someone climbs up on his roof and prays to God, please, God, make a miracle and save me. And then a boat comes by and says, come on, get in the boat, I'll take you. And he says, no, I'm waiting for God to make a miracle and save me. Come on in the boat. And he says, no. And then a helicopter comes by and says, come on, we'll pull you up. And the water's getting higher and higher and higher and higher. And he says, no, I'm waiting for God. I really have faith in God that God's going to save me. And the helicopter gives up and goes away. And then the water goes higher and higher and he drowns. And he shows up in heaven and he says to God, he said, I had such faith in you and I prayed to you and you didn't save me. Why not? He says, well, look, I sent a boat for you. I sent a helicopter for you, but you kept on refusing them. What can I do? So what it's about is the fact that there are all these circumstance opportunities that we have all the time, from when we open our eyes in the morning and take a breath. But it's up to us to make good use of that. And that's what he's saying in this very last paragraph, where the sentence says, since it is indeed difficult to be born as a human being, do not miss this opportunity that you have, because you are as you are right now. See, it's up to you, and you have the ability, if you're willing to see that what you are is the ability to realize who you are, and that your circumstances as they are make it possible if you start using what you have. Then new circumstances will appear, so to speak. Because the simplicity of practice can begin wherever we are. Did I talk last week about Soen Roshi? No, I didn't. I think I just mentioned that to someone. Well, anyway, I want to stop now and see what you have comments, because we're coming. We have a limited amount of time, and I've been talking all about this, and you must have comments about this chapter. Anyone?
Just a couple of things. I was struck, you know, by his reference to committing suicide.
Yes.
I can't remember exactly where he says. I know. I mean, it's on that page 14 a little bit, but at some point he talks. He kind of talks about it. In a certain way that I found a little disturbing, in that it seemed a little unidimensional to me, which I think is real. Maybe it's in the next chapter where he does that. I'm not certain.
What?
He talks about it.
Where?
Well, I'm trying to find it.
On the top of page 14, he talks about suicide a few times.
I think I may have actually seen it someplace else too. That's okay. But at any rate, he's talking about it being against Buddhist precepts, and suicide is actually against other religions too. You'll find that in Judaism. But at the same time, many religions have sort of, if you will, evolved to recognize that the person who kills themselves is often the victim in the sense of illness, you know, maybe deep illness, a lot of things going on there.
Right.
I just wanted to mention that because I think it's a complicated topic.
Yes.
Something you can just say, well, that's because somebody was just so selfish that they did that.
It doesn't say selfish.
No, it doesn't.
In fact, he turns it around and says, even though you shouldn't do it, there's times you should do it, or it's perfectly good to do it.
And that he's talking about because you've talked about this before, you know, like these Buddhist monks who burned themselves because they were trying to bring attention to the plight of, you know, suppression of religion or something, right? That's all. I just thought it was interesting that he mentioned it. That's all.
Yeah. You have to see that there's a fluidity, even though, because he says, even though it's so-called sinful, I mean, that's the translation in English. I don't know if we'd use that word. But anyway, nevertheless, he says, they did it because they felt it was necessary, and it goes from there. Just like earlier when he talks about people in Scandinavian countries where they're comfortable, and yet he says these people feel that life is not worth living. They can't find meaning, and thus suicide is a rebellion against the tasteless existence and tedium.
Yeah, so, that's where it was, yeah.
So, in a sense, we have to remember, this is a, you know, he's touching on things, but it's not, there's only so much he's going to do in a short paragraph about it. So on one hand, they're so-called precepts, but on the other hand, really when you look at the precepts, and particularly in the tradition where he comes from, there's three different ways to deal with each precept, and those three ways are sometimes and often inherently contradictory. Inherently contradictory. I talk about this a little bit in my discussion of precepts in my books, because it's not the way it is in the Christian or even Jewish traditions where there tend to be more hard and fast rules. There's the need, how do we do things in ways where you've got three contradictory and seemingly opposite ways of doing the same precept? To go into that in depth is a much deeper discussion, and as I said, I've talked about it, and I'm glad to talk about individually, but that's really in part what our practice is. Because our tendency to be, what should I say, literal and narrow, it often stems from narrow perspectives on what our life is, and either-or perspectives. And that's what this whole, these first two chapters want to begin us to looking at if we go back to what I started tonight with, the roles that we're playing on one hand, being a beggar or a rich person, and on the other hand, being neither of those, and therefore being fine with whichever one of those roles we get. It's almost like we draw cards, and whichever role we get, that's the one we get to play. And yet, we could get caught up and think, well, if I'm playing this role, that's good, but if I'm playing that role, it's bad, and a reason to get angry, and it's not as important a role, etc. And that just is the perpetuation of reactive self-centeredness. But this, remember, if we want to talk about this, please bring it up, because he's just starting us in the direction, which is why I want to hear more from you on these things. So, if people have things to say, fine, and if not, chew on it, think about it, and then come back next week and we could talk further about it. If you have this on your computer, on a PDF app of some sort, you know, I assume you know, and if not, I'll remind you, you can usually make notes on the side of the text very easily, and therefore easily bring it up, whatever device you have. So please do that.
Can we come back to this then next time? The last paragraph, I did have something I'd like to explore about the last paragraph on page 14.
Since it is indeed difficult. Good. Okay.
Yeah, we're running out of time now.
Yeah, but, okay, so I'll try to remember that you're going to, in fact, I'll put a note on mine that says Faye is going to talk about this.
Well, to start, and see what other people want to say about it, too.
Okay. Anyone else?
Well, Elihu, I did have one quick thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, on the very first page, page 12, you know, where he says right off, the two strongest desires are the desire to eat and sexual desire. Why didn't he mention happiness? You know, I think that, or is that too simplistic?
I don't know why he didn't mention, he sees both of those as a part of the life preservation. And you could say happiness, but if you're very, very hungry, happiness sort of disappears. And sometimes, as he says, when we're younger, we're very driven sexually. Remember, he's talking about that as a desire and an instinct which we have less control over things. But he's talking about these as urges. Maybe you want to say happiness, but happiness, I don't know. We could add that as a potential.
Yeah, happiness and well-being, maybe, but then that includes a lot of other things.
Well, that's life preservation, well-being.
Yeah.
It depends how abstract we go. And part of it we see in more extreme circumstances that happiness and well-being is a luxury that we, in where we're in a wealthier society, can talk about this And it might be that that's less strong when we're missing food or whatever.
Right. Okay.
But
okay.
We still have a minute or two?
Sure, we have as much as time as you want.
I'm not sure what page you guys have this on, but just that that the urge is to seek endless life and endless expansion. In that small little paragraph there, I don't know what page that is on yours. Mine's page 8. Did you find that part there?
Endless life and endless expansion. Is it on the first page of Buddha Nature or the second page?
Oh, let me see here. It's the 8 paragraph. In that Buddha Nature.
Uh-huh.
Real short period right after the...
Oh, yeah. It's the last, almost the last sentence of the, on page
13. Oh, 13, yeah. And it Buddhism teaches us how to satisfy this urge. It doesn't quite ring right to me somehow,
Wait. I see, yes. Well, our urge is to seek endless life and endless expansion. Buddhism teaches us how to... Well, endless life in
so
this...
So the universe itself.
What?
Not out, expanding it to whatever, you know. And we're part of that, I guess.
Well, you're mumbling. Please speak up. Hello?
Yeah?
Can you say that, what you just said again, and but louder?
Oh, I just say this endless... life and endless expansion sounds like a metaphor, you know, not just a metaphor, but it's an actual description of the universe itself, you know, and which includes us as well.
Well, that's a little too abstract and general.
I
mean,
abstract.
He's talking about specifically that we want to live. It's rare that we are willing to say, oh, I'll give up my life. He means this very specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is where he just talked about even people who are dying or sick, and he talks about wanting to lengthen our life and wanting to keep expanding what we have in different ways.
Yes, yes. But that to satisfy this urge teaches us how to... That doesn't sound quite right to me, but...
Well, as I emphasized, it's not how to... The urge isn't something that we decide to do. This urge arises, and he's talking about how do we satisfy it in a way that doesn't cause more harming and suffering, and satisfy it in a way so that it nurtures both joyousness, if I'll say it that way, and nurtures the ability to be satisfied and at peace, and nurtures the ability to be compassionate. So that's what he means by Buddhism teaches us how to satisfy this urge. In other words, how to be able to be satisfied. Knowing how to be satisfied is one of the important parts. The Dogen and the Buddha talk about these as the eight, this is the last, one of the last sermons of the Buddha and the last sermon of Dogen. Knowing how to be satisfied is called one of the 8 awarenesses of a wise person, of a great person. Knowing how to be satisfied. Because we have a tendency to keep, we get satisfied for a little bit. You know, we eat ice cream and we enjoy it. And as soon as we finish the ice cream, very soon afterwards, we think about the next thing we want to get. It might be a movie. It might be a drink. It might be, I want to go here. But the next, because we have a difficulty in being able to stay with that satisfaction, and then let go of the next urge that comes up, so to speak. Or the urges are constantly piling up. Well, I've got my new car, but I need to get better speakers or better, you know, I need a new phone so that when I'm in the car, I can use the newest phone, or you fill in.
I see what he's, yeah, as you explain it, I can see.
I mean, remember, this is just a generalization, and it's always in the specifics. But what he's saying is, if we see desires for what they are, then we could see what's appropriate and what's not skillful, which are harmful and which nurture us. If we can't see them for what they are, and we can't see them for who we are, then we do all sorts of things in the attempt to satisfy, even as that causes harm to us or to others. So, but let's stop here, and we could continue next time, and if you want, write notes and bring it up next time. Okay? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good night.